I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Carrie Gilbert is the author of Little Red. It is a collection of new poems that begin with the Little Red Riding Hood story and its various versions and looks at girls and wolves, harm and violence, as well as youth and experience. The images are vivid and evoke the places in the heart and mind so well. You feel at times in a remote part of this province, just as you feel for those damaged. I'll ask Carrie about the poems in this collection, as well as committing poetry and the places she takes the reader to in this book. Carrie Gilbert teaches creative writing at Okanagan College in Vernon, British Columbia, where she joined me from about 3 weeks ago. Kerplunk, a verse novel of development, was her first collection of poetry, followed by Tight Wire, which was published by Mother Tongue, who publishes Little Red. She has been shortlisted for a number of prizes for her writing and poetry and received the Gwendolyn McEwen Poetry Prize for Best Suite by an Emerging Writer, 2016-2017. The website for more is at carriegilbert.ca. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Carrie Gilbert. Ms. Gilbert, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Do you remember where you were or when it was that you first heard, say, the Little Red Riding Hood story?
I don't have any specific memory when I was a kid of it, other than it seemed to be a pervasive story throughout childhood in different ways. And the original story I didn't learn until I was much older, but definitely that kind of watered-down fairy tale version of it, I remember at different times throughout childhood.
Throughout your collection, Little Red, you know, we see the character of the wolf come in various ways, in various iterations, if you will, various versions of the wolf. But I always wondered, as I was reading the book, if wolves are actually bad characters. I mean, I guess the fairy tale has made us think, they've gotten a bad rap, if you will.
Absolutely, and I actually think that the wolf isn't necessarily... I was hoping throughout the collection to complexify that character a little bit so that we didn't just think of it as good and bad, that we could think of the humanity of that character as well. But for me, I think wolf equals fear, and I think that's part of all of us, good and bad. So it's not necessarily just a bad character or a bad thing. It can actually be a positive as well.
Yeah, and that's the thing about wolves, isn't it? That doesn't matter where you are. There are wolves, I guess, as opposed to, say, other predatory things like lions or tigers. You wouldn't see those sorts of animals, I guess, in our part of the world, if you will, as opposed to a wolf, right?
That's right.
Yeah. What... The thing that also struck me, because at the beginning and the end of the book are I guess, retellings, if you will, or tellings of the Little Red Riding Hood story. There's such lessons in fairy tales that it's so easy that we lose sight of them, as not only as children, but as adults. And I'm wondering, is thinking about these things, as you have in the course of writing the poems that are in this collection, is it something that I guess these are things that we go back to, right?
Yeah, I think they're actually just part of human nature. And I think they come easy to us, these kind of ways of explaining the world, and through story, through narrative. And I think that just is naturally human for us to do so, which I think is why this story has lasted so long.
Mm-hmm.
It's an easy way to explain some very complex issues in the world, and easy enough that I think even if a kid hears the story, they can pick up on the nuances of what the story's about. So it's so fundamental in our way of making sense of the world, I think.
And we need the reminding, don't we, regularly?
I think so. And I think, you know, what really got me thinking about this a lot, especially as a parent, I have kids as well, is how we protect our children and what we say to them and what we don't say to them. And I do feel like we're in a time in our culture where we're kind of sheltering and protecting kids from things that are happening, and, you know, that idea of the helicopter parent,
right,
where if you hover enough, nothing bad will ever happen to your child. But in reality, I think if you overprotect your child, you're not setting them up to deal with some of the things that they'll have to deal with later in life.
See, I don't have kids. I'm 37, so I still think I'm you know, close enough to remember what being a kid was like.
Mm-hmm.
The sense that I get as I was reading the collection is that there's great anxiety about being a parent. And I guess that's probably why I'm not a parent today.
It's a good reason not to, and a good reason to have kids, both. But, you know, I wasn't expecting that, becoming a parent. You kind of expect the all the things that go with being a parent, good and bad. But I wasn't expecting the huge weight of anxiety that came even before the kids came, as soon as we knew we were having kids. It doesn't leave. It doesn't change, even though my kids are a bit older now. You just worry about different things.
What wonders about that? Because I was going to ask you, I mean, as they get older, does it lessen, I guess. It does change, doesn't it? And I guess that's with you for the rest of your life, isn't it?
I think so. I think it just morphs, and the concerns change. When they're very, very little, you know, really obvious things like keeping them safe from themselves and the things that could happen around them. And as they get older and become more social, it becomes more about the world and the influence of the world on them and how they're going to deal with that. And I, you know, even looking at my own parents, I have a feeling that that doesn't even change once they're adults. So I do think it's lifelong.
Yeah, and there are children that you write about in the book, or that appear in the book, I should say, that have encountered difficulty, have encountered challenges, and you get a real sense as one reads these poems of the real vulnerability of children and how important it is to look after them, because they are young people, aren't they? And there are a lot of people who don't have those adults around them who carry that, say, anxiety about them that they should have, I suppose.
Yeah, I think they're easy to forget about in a culture, in a way, too, right? It's easy to get caught up in the big picture of things that are happening in the world, politically especially, and kind of forget about the children as being the next group to be our citizens, to be our people who run this world. And in some ways, it's really easy to lose sight of that and just forget that we have to nurture them and take care of them, but also teach them how to be functioning adults and be able to cope with stress and anxiety and wolves and everything else that comes with being an adult and living in the world.
You teach creative writing, is that right?
I do, yeah, at Okanagan College.
Does writing poetry, does it inform the other writing that one might do? I mean, not all creative writers write poetry, so I'm wondering if one who does, what benefit they might have in terms of their other writing, say?
Yeah, I think it's actually really valuable to play in all genres when you're a writer, and I teach this to my students, that even if poetry doesn't come naturally to you or it's not something you're interested in, there's a lot of value in thinking poetically that I think helps inform other forms of storytelling, other kinds of narrative. The being able to condense an idea into something much more brief, and being able to focus on metaphor and imagery as being your strongest motivators for what you're doing, I think that helps inform every kind of writing.
And the reading of poetry, obviously, I mean, it is something you'd recommend. I mean, it is edifying, isn't it? And I guess necessary for a writer to say, develop whatever skills they might have.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit biased about this because I love reading poetry, but I do see the value in it, because I think all writing is argument in a way, that it's keeping on a conversation about things that are happening. But poetry is just a different way of looking at arguments. So I actually think it's quite valuable for us to be able to think metaphorically, which poetry really relies on, because it just allows us a different point of view of different ways of looking at things.
What mindset is one in when they're writing poetry? I mean, is this something that you have to sit down and do for yourself, or is this something that, you know, you'd be doing other things and something can, you know, strike, if you will?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I think there are times when I kind of force myself to sit down and work on something, work on some poetry, and then there are times where I have to write it no matter what else I'm doing. So, you know, doing dishes is a great example of that. For some reason, every time I do something domestic like that, I think as a way of procrastinating, my body tells me to go write a poem instead. But for me, I think poetry works really well for me as a format because I'm very fragmented in the way I think, and it takes me a really long time to come to terms with different ideas, especially big ideas. And there's something about the fragmentation of writing the poems that I can work through a big idea in that way. So when I am working through something larger or working on a big project, like when I was in Little Red and I was in that world, the thoughts would come to me at very random times, and it was just a way of me working through this big idea, and then just doing it in really manageable pieces of just one idea at a time, one image at a time.
And because the poems vary in length and the sort, I guess whatever image you're thinking in your head, as it translates through your hands as you're writing, because one wonders when it's done, and I suppose once it's complete in your mind, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, a lot of writers have different answers for this, but I feel like I'm done when I don't have that energy to keep going. I actually feel like it's a physical place where I do hit a point where I'm like, I'm sure I could keep going on this, but I feel in my body that I'm done writing these poems, and then it's a matter of moving them around and seeing if I have given enough, or if I haven't given the reader enough to get to where I was trying to go with it. But it really is a physical feeling for me that's it. I'm not working on this one anymore.
Is it fatigue, do you think?
A little bit.
Yeah.
I feel like especially working on something larger, so they're not just individual poems that stand on their own. They really need to be read together and work together as a group. I feel like when you live in that world of making those connections and trying to make sure the strength of everything holds together, I do feel like you hit a point of exhaustion after a while. It's like holding a world up, right? I think in the same way that novelists must feel about writing larger worlds.
And so when you go back and read a poem, say, that's in a collection like Little Red, because it's been a while since you finished it, is there any tendency to change something or something like that, or revise maybe something you've written?
I find maybe individual words might pop out, and I think, oh, I might have changed that word. But by the time the whole collection is together, I feel like it's working in its own context, and I'd be really leery of starting to take apart those things, because then I feel like it exists beyond me at that point, and I could always nitpick little things, but nothing in terms of the whole structure. I feel like once that's done, that exists beyond me, and I'm not going to touch it anymore.
The images that you evoke in various poems in Little Red are quite vivid, and the way you describe certain people, and you know, there's one poem in particular we talk about, you know, that you're walking down the street, if you will, and the various people that you encounter regularly that you don't know, but because you see them often, you do know of them, if you will, and you feel like you know them, and there's all the speculation that goes on in one's head. The thing that struck me as reading some of the poems of the book, it just seems effortless, and we've just talked about how much work goes into a poem. When someone says that it seems effortless, I guess in a way that that's a compliment, but at the same time, it can sort of discount the terror and the hard work that goes into writing, say.
Well, I think maybe that speaks something towards authenticity. I think, you know, I wrote this in a space that I know very well. So, yes, there was a lot of work to get it together, but I don't feel like I was writing out of my knowledge wheelhouse. You know, everything that I wrote about has happened, and has happened mostly in the area that I know, in the setting that I know. So in that way, that is a huge compliment to me, thank you, that it came across that way. But I think just being immersed in that world helps for that to come across.
Did you grow up in Vernon?
I did, yeah. I wasn't born here, but I've spent most of my childhood here.
As I was reading the book, I mean, I've jotted a few things down, and some of the things we've already touched on. It seemed like because I've grown up in Vancouver my whole life, and
okay.
I haven't traveled the province as I should. I've never been to Vernon, say, or other parts of the Okanagan. At the same time as where various places that you write about seemed familiar, they seemed foreign, if you will, and. I don't know if it's if I boiled it down, I'd simply say, well, it's, you know, I've lived in a more urban place, and it's a more rural, but it's more nuanced than that, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that, for me, the capturing the small town idea of Vernon was really important, without naming that we're in Vernon, in
yeah.
terms of that, because I think there's a relatability about that kind of small-town feel that doesn't just last here. You can pick it up in different spots all over Canada, I'm sure. But I wonder, too, if the urban fears are more than the kind of rural fears that happen in smaller towns. What do you think about that in terms of our day-to-day fears?
Yeah, I got the as I was reading about some of the people, if you will, that you depict, a lot of the fears are people themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I tend to think that I guess it's just luck on my part or good fortune that I've never, you know, walked in Vancouver and had certain. I mean, well, I guess there's certain privilege in that because I'm a male, if you will. That I don't fear, say, other people as you know, as I can see children might in where I am or where they are, where you live, say.
Mm-hmm.
And so that vulnerability or that, I guess, tenuous of safety, if you will, is, I'd say constant, but I mean, it's there, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, you brought up the privilege. I think there are other places and other scenarios where the fear is far more real and the fear is far more prevalent than some of the day-to-day fears here. But I think part of the anxiety I was picking up on were even, you know, the fears that are happening far away, too.
Yeah.
So I bring up Syrian refugees, for example, as
right.
a motif throughout. And just the news that we do get day to day about the things that are happening in the world and how that can make anybody feel so anxious about what it means to be a human
yeah.
these days and how humans are treating each other. So I think the fear can extend beyond just your day-to-day right into, you know, worldwide fears.
Yeah, there's a poem in the book. It begins with Hugh Hefner.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes into Weinstein and it goes into Trump. I suppose, you know, we all get our news off the social media and nowadays. And We're really bombarded with it, and you try to get away from it, and it's there, isn't it, on your phone or on your computer screen or TV screen, that you're constantly thinking about, you know, the bad that's not only in, say, your neighborhood or in your city,
mm-hmm.
but the wider world.
And then how do you raise little people with that kind of pervasive fear without giving them that fear and being so fearful of the world that they don't go and live their lives.
Yeah.
So it's a big question, I think, that all of us deal with.
Yeah, you quote Weinstein and the various things that he said and Trump in that piece.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, it points to this, the importance of language because, you know, young people hear this stuff, obviously, and they think that that might be a way of getting along, say, in society. And I guess, again, the anxiety of being a parent, you know, what do you say when they say, well, I can say this because, you know, the president said this?
Mm-hmm. No, it's really problematic. But I also, you know, one thing I did try and work through with the manuscript, and this was in big kudos to my publisher, Mona Fertig. She really kept coming back to this idea of where's the hope, and we want to make sure that we don't lose the hope in all of this, that you don't get so wrapped up in the Trumps and the Weinsteins and the Hefners that you kind of lose sight that there is hope as well. And I actually see that poem as super hopeful, and this idea that that we're talking about these things and we're having conversations, and some of this negativity has bubbled to the surface so that we can actually deal with it in society. And I think, you know, breaking silence is a very powerful way of creating change.
Yeah, I mean, I read the book, obviously, thinking, you know, that sort of understanding better the anxiety of being a parent and the anxiety of, say, you know, just trying to make your way in the world, wherever your world is. So you are left with hope, are you, after finishing the book?
I think so. I was hoping to. This idea of change can happen, and I was really hoping to do that with that last line in the book where little Red went happily home and no one harmed her.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the variation of the Grimm story that was done in 1823 where the second part of the story that Nana or Grandma and little Red actually fool the wolf and trick him into thinking that they're not there. And then they kill Wolf instead of the other way around.
Yeah.
So this idea that change can happen and we can protect ourselves and we can think about the story in a different way.
I was going to ask you, Carrie, about how your work should be read. I guess you do have to read Little Red from beginning to the end, sort of in order, don't you?
I think the first time you read it, that would be helpful.
Yeah.
I've spent a lot of time with the juxtaposition of certain poems next to others to kind of riff off of each other. So I do see the whole thing as a narrative combined and that it would help to read it from start to finish. And then I think on any kind of other reading, you could flip through and read certain poems on their own because they would have the context then of the whole after you've read the whole thing.
Yeah. You mentioned working with Mona Fertig, your publisher, a great admirer of her and her work. What was it like to work with her in terms of say, giving your poems over to her and having them, having sort of the input of an editor, of a publisher?
Yeah, I've worked with her twice. She also published my book, Tight Wire, and then I was lucky enough to work with her again for Little Red, and it was absolutely a phenomenal experience for me both times. Mona is so kind and generous in what she does, and just the trust that she put into what I was doing and the trust I put into her suggestions as well. It was such a collaboration right from the very beginning, and it was just a gift, really, for me to be able to work with someone who gave me so much artistic freedom to do what I wanted to do.
The other thing I was thinking about, just as we're chatting and as I was thinking about the poems in your book last night, preparing for our conversation, does a poet write to be read? I mean, because I don't write, and as I told you before we started, reading poetry has always been a challenge for me. I wonder, you know, are there poems where it's just enough that you've written it for yourself? I mean, does it have to be read by someone else? Does it have to be read by a wider audience, say?
I don't know. I think yes and no. I think there are things that I write that are certainly not for an audience at all.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are things that I write and there's an instinct to want to share that with other people. And I know that there's not a huge, massive audience of people who read poetry, but there's something really rewarding in those people who do read it and appreciate it and connect with what it is you're doing, because it really is a different way to see the world and a different way to see narrative. And there's something really rewarding thinking about people who get that. And for me, it's like a recognition of, I know you think differently, and I get it, and I understand what it is that you're doing. So there's something really beautiful about that. But for me to write, I have to actually picture nobody reading it at all, in a sense. I have a really small group of people that I think of as my audience, because if I thought of a mass audience reading the work, I think that would be enough to stop me from writing. It would be way too intimidating.
Right. What is it like then when you encounter readers who have read a poem of yours?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it must be gratifying if they get the same things out of it that you did. But what if they have a different view of things after, you know, the same poem, say? I mean,
I think that's beautiful, actually.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, the connections that other people can make are just as rewarding as the connections that I find that surprise me in the writing as well. And then there's these beautiful moments. Just last week I received a letter from someone who's living in Japan, and he's from Vernon as well, and he's also a writer, but his dad had sent him the book, and he sent me this beautiful letter of what the connections that he made from the work, and it was just super rewarding to think that you can connect with other people in that way.
And so far away, too, right?
Far away, yeah. Someone in Japan is holding the book. It's really awesome.
Someone you mentioned a couple times in the book, Jason Aldean, is he someone that you like listening to, say?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
I don't, I'm not really actually all that familiar with his work, but he became really interestingly connected to this book because one of the news articles that I had read early on in the writing of this book had to do with a concert that he gave in Calgary.
Mm.
And a young woman who was attending the concert was drugged at the concert by someone else and then went missing for, I think, 24 hours. And then they found her and she was alive. But that was kind of one of the first stories that got me thinking about Wolf, and it was his concert. And then what happened in another connection was the shooting in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Was while he was performing.
Yeah.
And so suddenly he kind of gained significance into the book in a really strange way for me. And I just let that happen because it felt like it needed to.
So we started the conversation talking about wolves and sort of how we view them, say, in our culture and our society.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of why people do bad things? I mean, why people say, you know, stir a roofie in the drink of someone else or shoot or attack, rape, kill?
Yeah, this is a huge question, and it's something I think about a lot. I kind of come to the realization that as a writer, my number one theme that I'm obsessed about, and I think it comes through in everything I write, is this sense of balance. And when we're imbalanced, it's when things don't work right. And I'm not making a statement about, you know, somebody's mental health. I'm kind of making a larger social statement.
Yeah.
That things seem to be out of whack. We're so far to one side or the other that we've kind of lost the equilibrium of the middle. And I feel like when big things happen like that, it's a direct correlation of things being out of balance and just not working as effectively as they can be. So to me, I think it's so many things that are out of balance, not just one thing.
And
I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, and so what, so one wonders, I mean, just thinking about taking it politically, if you will. I don't think we'll ever get back to a balance in that regard. I mean, it sort of swings one way and then goes the other way. And sometimes it stays one way longer than the other. But, I mean, you know, there is change often. I mean, these things go in cycles, if you will.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it's a good thing, though, right?
It's a good thing. And I actually think, you kind of back to, I think we talked about social media just a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think it's allowing for more of the voices of the middle to come out to
right.
the surface.
Yeah.
And even though it has all kinds of negative things, it can actually serve as a positive as well. There are a lot more voices that we're hearing now that we haven't heard in the past in these kind of debates and these kind of political arguments.
It's been such a pleasure to talk to you about this book. I mean, it's a book that I read with great interest, obviously, because I'm about to talk to you about it. But at the same time, you know, it's sort of stayed with me days and weeks after reading some of the poems in it and given me a lot to think about. I don't know if that was the goal, say, as a writer. But,
thank you. That's a huge compliment.
But it's just so many vivid images that just stay with you. And I appreciate your time. I've kept you longer than I said I would, but I mean, I could talk
all day
with you.
Thank you so much for the chat.
The book is called Little Red. It is published by Mother Tongue. Carrie Gilbert joined me on the line from Vernon, British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.